But is it cake? In honor of Palm Springs, what's your worst thing that has happened to you at a wedding?
I'm Katie Rich, and one time I was at a wedding in Stamford, Connecticut, and twisted my ankle wandering the hallways of the hotel looking for the after party, and then had to make my way back into New York City via train as a result. And then the marriage didn't even last.
Oof.
Boy, Stamford, the city that works.
nothing good happens in Stamford.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with the time that I had to drive David all the way to the airport at like fucking 5 a.m. because for some reason he scheduled his plane for goddamn 7 a.m. or some shit and didn't have a plan on getting back to the airport. So I had to drive him 2 hours from where the wedding was all the way back to the goddamn airport. My plane was much later.
I have no recollection of that.
This is a Katie's one.
I have no recollection of it either.
You have no recollection because you got to sleep in the back of the car that I rented. So I had to drive.
I vividly remember driving to Katie's wedding with Mike Ryan and Kate Erbland and Dave Gonzalez.
Back, you motherfucker.
And we stopped at a Sonic during magic hour, and it was like we were into the wonder. It was beautiful.
The good times. I'm talking about the bad times.
Yeah, I do not recall.
I'm David the Seven, and that time I had to run across a field with Java as Katie was walking down the aisle because we had gone to the wrong wedding and we were trying not to catch people's eye. Also, Katie's wedding.
David, you gonna make it a trifecta?
I'm David Ehrlich. I had a absolutely lovely time at Katie's wedding. Was a bit horrifying at Matt Patch's wedding when immediately after his vows, I cut into his flesh with a steak knife, believing that he was cake, only to find out that I was mistaken and the cake was actually in a tier, traditional wedding cake style, a few feet away. But live and learn.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 308, Pandemic 18. It's the week of Wednesday, July 15, 2020. That was the day that a 1988 Die Hard, which is a Christmas movie, opened in theaters. I didn't know that. Funny how that works.
Christmas movie in July.
I know. Christmas in July. Who ever heard of such a thing? That's actually literally a category being advertised on HBO Max right now. I'm back. Thank you all for bearing with me without me last week. I heard Patches saw Hamilton. I'm really excited that our long national nightmare is over.
It was pretty great.
Seeing it just before the podcast, so it's still in my head. I would definitely have sung that at a chorus recital in high school. I'm so glad that musical did not come out.
Which Hamilton song would have been your audition song in high school, Patches?
Oh, the King song.
You'll be back.
I would not be capable of singing any of the other songs, but if that song had been around in high school, I would have dressed up as a king and sang it for my whole high school. That is how I did things. I dressed up in togas to sing, what's it called from Jesus Christ Superstar. What's
King Herod's song?
Your favorite karaoke song. Yeah, King Herod's song.
I
would have auditioned for George and been cast as Samuel Sebring.
Savory, yeah. David, I hear we
our
have
Hamilton
reviews.
Episode probably went over very well. We got great reviews for it.
What does everyone think about Patches and Hamilton?
Viral sensation.
I forgot. Last week's episode, we spent an hour and a half dragging some kid from Emerson College. So that's what Katie really missed. And I'm sure the reviews are going to be raves.
Yeah, all about Hamilton, I'm sure.
It does seem like we are going to continue that plot thread. That story arc is now merging into its second episode.
Oh, yeah. This is a narrative podcast.
I just glanced at the top line of our most recent review, and here we go. Ben Popolis says, "Righting the wrongs of my college. Hiya. Been meaning to write this for a while, et cetera, et cetera. But last week's review from an Emerson student has forced me to brave the wonkiness of Apple's podcasting app, which, sidebar, truly is almost unusably wonky, as are all of their audio-based apps. It drives me fucking insane. Anyway, they're leaving this review. As someone who also goes to Emerson, I'd like to say I love the video games talk. Even though Ehrlich is incredibly long wrong about The Last of Us Part 2, I still find you all's discussions interesting. Love the show, no matter what the discussion is. P.S. David just got an email. P.S. I have heard Ehrlich's name come up at a number of Emerson College parties. I am officially hashtag Emerson famous. This is a big deal for me. But I'd say it's a
50-50 split. Maybe it is time for liberal institutions to shut down for a while and figure things out.
Ben Popolis would say it's a 50-50 split as to whether or not it's a positive or a negative mention of me.
That seems about the best you could hope for.
You know, I thought, I aspire anyway to a 60-40 split. I think that's really the ceiling that my personality and voice would be able to earn for myself at Emerson. I think we could probably do a little bit better 50-50. I'd say that's my goal for the rest of 2020, even though I take it that there may not be all that many more Emerson College parties for the remainder of this calendar year. If there are any Zoom get-togethers and my name happens to come up as often as it apparently does at these things, I'm just, you know, any if there's just a slight majority of positive, even connotation to the way that my name comes up, that would really help me get towards the ratio that I'm looking for. But this review was helpful. It gave me a solid baseline. I appreciate that, Ben Popolis. I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about, Last of Us Part 2, but the rest of it all seems to check out. I will also say, relative to the email that I got in the middle of reading that review, my email was a Variety breaking news break that Tucker Carlson is doing the classic thing that any Fox News host does when they get into hot water, which is to take a vacation, which cancel culture run amok. But no, I, as a mental health initiative, silenced the text message and email apps on my desktop today, and clearly all of my anxiety has melted away, and I'm now sane.
And maybe I'll Tucker Carlson unbidden. That sounds great.
That's on my laptop, but I'll have to do the same thing here. We have one more review from Daniel F! Exclamation point, who says, "Great podcast. Found this podcast early on within this quarantine, and only clicked because of the name, and this podcast has nothing to do with Dr. Strangelove, but I'm not complaining. I really enjoy this podcast with a good mix of social awareness, children, and obviously movie. Make these for another 10 years. Signed sincerely, the Dean of Students of Emerson College."
We've never done Dr. Strangelove, have we?
In what sense?
Just sat around
like we
and
never
talked
like
about
done
it?
An, yeah, we've never like never like talked about it on an episode. Right?
Not that I can
I remember if we
can't
had.
Remember. Seems like we have.
That's
a good movie.
May have come up at some point. But I also, before we move on, I have to be curious if Ben Popolis and Johnny from our previous episode, a.k.a. Speed Racer 2008, know each other, or if they're traveling in different film-centric circles in the Emerson College social scene.
The most recent review sounded like a joke about Emerson, don't you think?
No.
Oh.
Okay. It can be hard to tell with the levels of veiled irony.
The first review sounded legitimately Emerson. The second one sounded like a joke.
No, especially with the PS about being at Emerson. I don't know. I could very easily be wrong, but my initial inclination is that both of them were all too sincere.
If Emerson is anything like the small liberal arts college I went to, there aren't a ton of film-centric circles, so my guess is they overlap.
Well, Ben and Johnny, please fight to the death for my honor. Although, you know, it sounds like Ben is still neutral on me. It didn't sound like he was a diehard fan, so maybe I'm going to be ganged up on. But we appreciate your feedback all the same. We will do a Fighting in the War Room show live at Emerson when, of course, it is safe to do so.
Yes.
And in the meantime, please leave us a review on iTunes of Fighting in the War Room. We love to hear from you. We will read them, good, bad, somewhere in between. Even if you're not a student at Emerson, God forbid, live on the show. Great to hear from you guys. Thanks. Onwards.
Guys, I'm back. I was mostly with my family for a week and watched a lot of Hamilton, but I watched movies. There's a lot of them right now. Movies.
There were
They're
movies
good.
To watch.
Yeah. There were like
what a fun feeling.
Yeah, well, we're not even talking about First Cow, which I guess I had seen, you know, before Shutdown happened and is now on VOD. But Palm Springs is one of those movies that feels like people have been talking about forever because it was at Sundance. David and Patches, did you guys both see Palm Springs at Sundance? We must have talked about it back then at some point.
I did.
I did not.
Oh.
I saw it in home viewing where it was meant to be seen.
Patches was not doing a good job of chasing the zeitgeist. He didn't have his finger on the pulse. The Jeffrey Wells of the world would say that he is a lost samurai.
To be fair, I had for the first time Sundance, I had a second person. I had a partner in crime at Sundance, so that person. So, yeah. And reviewed it. I Polygon.
And reviewed Palm Springs and was quite taken with it, but I think Katie has more setup to do. So.
Oh, I mean, we should probably say that, like, spoilers for the concept of Palm Springs. I feel like it's been, like, after Sundance, there was all these things being like, don't know anything about it. Like, you don't want to even know what classic movie it's being compared to. And I kind of got wind of the concept even from that. But are we going to accept that the concept of Palm Springs is not a spoiler for the purposes of this conversation?
Well, I think we should say that it is a spoiler. And if you haven't seen the movie and you've somehow preserved yourself, then you should go see it. Because I have mentioned the plot to people who didn't know, and they were like, that seems like something I'd want to find out.
I mean,
it's Michelle, revealed, my wife, scolded me for telling people.
It's got to be we can have the first 15 minutes of the movie.
We can have it both ways. Where it's, yes, I can completely appreciate that the movie is all that much more fun to go into a blind, as I had the good fortune of doing at Sundance. At the same time, I open my review with a revealing, with no spoiler warning or any beating around the bush, the premise of the movie, because I made a value judgment at the time that it was impossible to talk about meaningfully without
and
really
it is impossible. So for this segment, we'll spoil it.
Yes. So, but
this moment.
We are talking again, just to emphasize for those of you who are curious about this movie but haven't seen it, we are talking about the fundamental premise of the movie, not a plot twist of any kind that happens down the road. It is fun to find your way in the dark and put the premise together over the course of the first 10 or 15 minutes, but once you get over that hump, it's not...
Well, I may have a spoiler question for the end of this. Fine. Super spoiler.
Sure.
It's not a mind blower,
All right, it's a time loop movie. It's like Groundhog Day.
It's a Groundhog Day situation.
It's a Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is the best movie ever made, and then they made another movie that has the same premise.
I forgot that you thought that you're a hardcore Groundhog Day fan. I feel like it does a good job of taking the premise of Groundhog Day, but not trying to be Groundhog Day, which I think is the only way you can do it. Like, I can't put my finger on why. Like, it's a romantic comedy that is like Groundhog Day, but is not. But I feel like that is the entire key to the success
of this movie.
It kind
of builds off Groundhog Day. Like, it's almost like Groundhog Day happened, and then they made a movie where someone gets sucked into Groundhog Day.
And, like, learns how to do it better than Bill Murray did.
The whole thing that gives Palm Springs its life and makes it feel like it is Groundhog Day, but not also completely indebted to that format, it breaks the mold. There have been so many iterations of the whole stuck in a time loop thing, but as far as I know, this is the very first one that suggested what if two people were stuck in the time loop together, and that is a total.
Well, not only that, what if three people?
Well, okay, now
or possibly four.
Twist. Oh yes, that.
But this movie, I mean, that really is the thing that puts it on a different, totally different tack from others movies like it, and it's fundamental to what it's doing, because this movie, at least, you know, to my read of it, is about monogamy. It is blatantly pro-marriage propaganda, which at least three people on this podcast I think could subscribe to, and it's a movie about being stuck for all eternity, maybe, with one other person, and going through all the permutations of what that's going to be like, all the emotional highs and lows, peaks and valleys, and reckoning with what it can mean, and finding, which is increasingly difficult to do, especially on screen, some kind of upside for that, that is not just simply happily ever after, but a little bit more textured and complicated. And I think to that end, it is very, very successful.
Yeah, who needs three before movies when you have a time loop movie? Can just do the whole, all the relationship things all at once in one movie. My point about it building on Groundhog Day is that I feel like in Groundhog Day, you couldn't do this movie as the first time loop movie. I think you needed, because I do think Groundhog Day, there's a read of that movie where it's like, could the could Andy McDowell's character be more dimensionalized or more going on there? But I think it would be really, really difficult because you're so immersed in Bill Murray's, Phil's time-looped perspective and what he learns through that journey. The Groundhog Day provides the foundation for Palm Springs. You know from the, like we said, you know from the very like first 5 or 10 minutes, as soon as Andy Samberg starts walking through a wedding, doing like maneuvering in and out of people in this kind of like coordinated dance, you know exactly what the gimmick here is and how much he's learned and how long he must have been stuck in this time loop, because he's immediately at the flat, like the third act beginning mark of Groundhog Day, where Phil is just, he's memorized the entire day beat for beat. Now we know exactly where Andy Samberg is, and another person can become incorporated. So it kind of builds on the logic. I don't think this movie could exist without Groundhog Day.
No. It's also, I can't remember if Groundhog Day is explicitly referenced by name, but the movie is also about people who have seen time loop movies. I mean, this concept is jarring for Christine Milioti's character. Kristen Milioti's character. Milioti. You know, Andy Samberg, by the time the movie begins, has already been stuck in a time loop for God knows how long and has made all of the jokes and figured out all the iterations of this thing and played with the format as much as he could. And that is sort of just downloading this idea to the audience of this is a film made by people who have seen every time loop movie and are trying to do something new with it. But it does, I think, as to what Patch is saying, it's absolutely right. I mean, it does start with that sort of knowledge going into it of we've all played this game before. We all know the rules.
Dave, what do you make of Palm Springs?
Oh, go ahead, Katie, and then I'll chime in.
Oh, I was just going to add on the whole comparing to Andy McDowell and Groundhog Day. Like, I think there's an issue in Groundhog Day and like also about time, which is a movie that I like didn't like as much as everybody else, with like consent of the romantic interest, like not knowing that this guy who's pursuing her has been like had a million times to do it. And Palm Springs gets into that explicitly, like kind of addressing like their relationship before she got stuck in the time loop and then allowing them to build a relationship by being in it together. That I think is really valuable by making it feel like a relationship you actually have stakes in. I don't think you could get away with doing the Groundhog Day version of it today.
No.
Yeah.
There's Dave, Palm Springs.
I think like the major difference for me between this and Groundhog Day is its way in and its way out isn't dependent on there being a moral balance to the universe. And I think because of that, not only does it, I think, free you up to... I think it frees you up to get crazier with a lot of the intercutting stuff. There's something, I think, with Groundhog Day because of the way it ends that sort of makes his series of suicides, like, darker. Just like the idea that there's a malevolent God force waiting to reset time for something correct to happen. And I like that this movie pretty early on is like, this is happening because of a magic MacGuffin and it has nothing to do with morality. So now where do we go from here? So in that sense, I think it does owe a lot to Groundhog Day.
Oh, where are you now? Sorry.
But I do think it just works really well because it manages to take that plot yet find all the necessary beats to have a romantic comedy. So even if things get absolutely crazy, and I think the, you know, textbook conclusion to this movie kind of is a weird idea that they just sort of execute. But at that point, the movie has established its rhythm. The movie has established there's no rules. And all you have is the familiar rules of a romantic comedy to let you know that eventually things are going to end up well. I like the tone of this movie because there's a tone of danger, but it's also a tone that stays silly. I think that the moments this movie tries to take its premise seriously, it chooses very selectively and I think smartly keeps a lot of it outside of the romance plot. But yeah, no, I really liked it. And I really like a lot of the character turns that, so the way that it's structured that I was talking about, like a romantic comedy means we have to learn things about these characters or about their situations, even though it's incapable for the situation around them to change. So it's sort of like fun reveals In the back half of this movie.
Well, some of them are sad reveals.
Yeah. Well, I think they're sad, but they're complicating.
Can we talk about the
one? Yeah, like, you can talk about the one.
Is that a spoiler?
Go ahead.
Well, let's talk a little few spoilers here, but like, are you talking, what about her? I mean, just to, I guess, we don't need to summarize the plot if we're going spoilers. You know, they're blowing each other up. They're dancing. They're falling in love. They sleep together. And then it turns out she's been sleeping with her soon-to-be-wed sister's future husband.
She wakes up every morning in the bed of her.
Right.
Yeah.
She knows this, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, she knows it all along.
Yeah, okay.
That's the thing that made me, you know, come to the conclusion that David did. That this is a lot more about, like, marriage or monogamy, because it's, like, the possibility that you can commit to somebody for a brief moment and then have to wake up next to them for the rest of your life, even as your understanding turns that into a nightmare, I think really speaks to something. So even if she does, you know, find true love in this time loop, it's always bringing her back to, like, basically her worst decision, which she made once.
I gave credit to it earlier for, like, addressing the idea of, like, what she knows and how much they know together in this time loop, but I didn't love the way that it turns on him revealing to her that they had slept together previously when it was just him in the time loop, and how that becomes, like, kind of the moment in, like, She's Not That, where it's like, I was just a bet. Like, it felt like a little artificial compared to the stakes of the rest of the movie, even though it's kind of the engine that makes the rest of it work. I don't know if it bothered anyone else.
I mean, I feel like, you know, it's never pleasant, but I think I've sort of taken it with a grain of salt or for granted at this point that all movies like this are going to have a I was just a fucking bet moment, of course, iconic. And I think, you know, there is I haven't seen the movie since January, but I do remember a little bit of dissonance in that the character by that point had started coming to terms with what the rules of this world are, but then was sort of still horrified anew by that revelation, when at that point, I think it would have made more sense for her to be like, yeah, that makes sense. You were here for a zillion years. You did everything you could possibly do. But I did enjoy how they get into, like, the logistics of what you would do if you only had a limited amount of time before everything reset. And Andy Samberg, you know, she's at one point, I think she says something to the effect of, like, you know, why aren't you having sex with everyone all the time? And he's just like, it's a lot of work.
I think she committed and let him sleep with Peter Gallagher and not make that a joke. They deserve to find happiness together.
I mean, I do love that commentary on this theme, where it's like people who actively adventure or fear monogamy, and they're just endlessly doing things, slowly succumb to the kind of malaise of just running away or escaping. That's a really fascinating. I don't feel like I've seen a lot of that on screen, because most stories can't be big enough to do that. You'd have to write a novel to really see someone's whole life in that perspective. And that's the beauty of the time loop.
I really enjoyed the J.K. Simmons character and how he's used. I think he's a bit of, you know, an annoyance at first. He tends to show up and interrupt scenes.
His annoyance is probably an understatement.
He's shooting arrows at Andy Samberg.
He does torch Andy Samberg in a pool at some point.
But the fact that he keeps interrupting these nice moments they're having means that he's also interrupting, you know, more often than not, enjoyable scenes. But I think it really does pay off with the further exploring the dynamic that he and Andy Samberg's character have.
This scene is sad. I mean, he doesn't get to see his kids grow up. He's trapped in a time loop.
But also the way I feel like the part of his story that resonated with me most is, like, when he's making peace with it, when he's sitting in his house and being like, listen, I get to spend this day with my kids. And I don't know, as, like, someone who has, like, spent a lot of extremely long days with my kids, where I, like, I wish that they could be in school or that my life could be normal, like, learning to step back and, like, take it for what it is. I feel like that stuck me even more than the film's argument for monogamy about, like, learning to be in the place that you are and not try to run past it.
We're going long on this, but here's my one super spoiler question to wrap up, which is, so in this movie, as Dave mentioned, we know why they're stuck in a time loop. There's a magic cave.
Yep.
And we learn early on, and I was like, whoa, they're going to just go for something. You know, the original script for Groundhog Day, I believe, had, like, a voodoo curse on Phil Connors, and that's why he was trapped in a time loop, and they made the correct decision, I would say. Cutting that.
That sounds like it would have aged fantastically.
Yeah. That would not have been good. But this movie has there's a reason. And there's also a reason how they get out. She, instead of like learning to play piano like Phil Connors, she studies string theory and builds a bomb that explodes them out of whatever.
Is this building to a question, or are you just spoiling what happens at the end of this movie for anyone?
I'm building up here because, and I wanted to go in depth on the explanation because the question is all of this explanation fun and satisfying, or is the groundhog way of doing it the kind of mystical, we'll never know. I mean, it's kind of what Dave was touching on with, like, there's no moral invisible being that you have to appeal to, and suddenly the switch is flipped. Here, it's a very clear explanation, and I don't know how that played for everybody. But people like that.
It's still having its cake and eating it too, right? I mean, the movie is a cake, as you will find out if you cut into it on your television, in that, you know, it is giving an explanation as to why this is happening more so or more tangibly than Groundhog Day does, but it's still a nonsense explanation that isn't rooted in, you know, they make jokes about string theory that she has to learn and spends God knows how long doing that, but it is still, you know, movie bullshit. And it doesn't pretend that it's anything more. And so it really, it's just trying to find a concrete way that she can take action to, you know, meaningful on her own to get out of this. I don't think it really matters what the, you know, what the MacGuffin, not that this is technically a MacGuffin, but whatever the mumbo jumbo you want to call it is.
It's about each of them having to make a choice and deciding to make it together. Like, you need to get them to the point of united to get out of it rather than just have it happen.
I want to retract the phrase mumbo jumbo, which I was just learning on Mental Floss, is a phrase with racist origins. So
I think it's incredibly efficient with how it uses the cave, the goat, and the old woman to plant enough sort of hints that there's more to this story, but that equally everything that you could see in this story would be something that was unsatisfying to the couple's story. And then I think ultimately the ending, because if it would have ended with an explosion and a that's the credits, this I would have been like, fuck this movie.
Yeah. What do you think June Squibb's deal is?
I don't think she's trapped in the time loop. I'm confused about this this theory. I think she's just having different responses based on the way they act in the given loop of that time. I don't know. I never really thought about it.
But why would she say you're going soon? Like, what's the, like, and like, she gets a look from Chris Milioti, like a very deliberate, like, huh, you've got something going on.
If she is in a time loop, it's sad.
Maybe they'll set her free just like they set J.K. Simmons free. And then she's gotten to be an old lady who's lived like forever and never aged and done all kinds of stuff. Maybe it's great.
They don't seem to know she's in the time loop. So, I mean, unlike J.K. Simmons.
No, but I think Chris Milioti knows that she's in the time loop. She has a look on her face where like she would be like the same way that she warned J.K. Simmons. She totally could have warned the other lady.
It's less.
Yeah, but we see her warn.
It's less tragic because she's not sad about it. And because it comes, the revelation that she could be part of it comes after J.K. Simmons literally lists the things that he's sad about. And she's probably done all those things. Like, she's probably
June Squibb may have no family at all, and it, being really old, she just wants to.
Well, and Kristen Milioti at one point is like,
time loop.
When she comes back, she's like, of course I look good, like, I don't age, so maybe, like, finding the cave maybe the cave was for this woman. Like I said, it gives you just enough to give you a hint that there could be, like, more out there, but not enough that I, like, need
but
a sequel
need
about
it.
What happened to the cave. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll write our fanfic next this week and present it on the next episode.
This is Dave. We're going to attempt to do a mini segment pandemic check-in. This is going to end up horribly, but here we go. We are each going to get to talk about one thing.
Wait, let me ask an off-topic question.
Oh, God damn it. Okay, go Patches.
When do we stop doing a pandemic? We've been listing, it's week 18, pandemic week 18.
Mm-hmm.
When does that end? When would we stop counting?
When we see Tenet in theaters.
Okay. That's,
ooh. You know
just
what?
Want
that's
to put
good.
That out there. I think that's good way to... to decide, because I don't think we're going to see a single movie in theaters for the rest of the year.
Probably not. And then think how high those numbers will be.
There's a segment for maybe next week or the week after, but about how at a certain point, I think because all the rest of the world is handling this so much better than we are, these movies will have to open, because we can't hold every movie theater in the world hostage just for American box office, and the studios will have to capitulate to some sort of VOD day and date.
Right, I'll rent a hazmat suit and see Tenet.
You're not going to be able to. Not in these countries, not in these states.
I'll rent a hazmat suit, fly to China, see Tenet.
Was that your pandemic check-in?
No, that was not my
pandemic check-in. That was just his preamble question.
That was my. I clearly stated it was a tangent question that was extending the length of our mini-segment.
All right.
I'll do my pandemic check-in really quick.
No. I'm setting the terms here. Here we go.
One more tangent question.
Here's an example. I watched a movie called We Are Little Zombies. It is a Japanese movie directed by Makoto Nagahisa. It is available in virtual theaters through Oscilloscope. It is about four children who are all orphaned at the beginning of the film. They meet outside the crematorium. They decide to form a punk band. It is like Japanese nihilism that looks like if Wes Anderson had directed Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I recommend you guys check it out, or at least check out the trailer on YouTube.
Dave, can we sing the song?
That we are little zombies. Anyway, it's pretty great. Check it out. There we go. Patches, go.
That was pretty good. I want to recommend... Have we talked about what we do in the Shadows Season 2 on this podcast yet?
Not on this podcast, huh?
I don't think we have.
I talked about it on my What We Do in the Shadows cast, but yeah, not...
Of course. Shadowcast? What's that called again?
It's called...
See how this banter is not content, though?
Lazlocast? Sorry. You're right. This is not content. This is content. So I've been watching the new episodes on season 2 on Hulu, and I gotta say, this is definitely the successor to The Office. Like, many shows have maybe tried to emulate The Office, and I'm not talking about the mockumentary format. I'm just talking about, like, comedy per minute and the pleasure of just sitting back and watching random episodes of this show. Such a strange show, such a strange cadence, but pure comedy. Jokes. Like, real jokes. And two episodes I watched back to back, and I have to recommend them. They're both kind of like mini masterpieces. One is about the character Colin, who sucks the, like, will to live out of people by being boring, and he gets a promotion at work. So it's like an Office Place comedy, except he's just trying to have the driest banter imaginable, and it is a beautiful piece of television. And the second episode is an episode that co-stars Mark Hamill as a really old-ass vampire who is chasing the one guy, Laszlo, and that's the first scene. Mark Hamill shows up at the door of the vampires. He's like, I challenge you to a duel because you owe me money for, like, rent or something. And instead of paying, Laszlo decides to go off and become this guy, Jackie Daytona, American bartender. And the episode, it's almost like an entirely different episode of television. It's about how he becomes a great part of a small Pennsylvania town and an inspirational figure to a women's volleyball team, local college volleyball team. And it's the most bizarre half hour of television I've seen maybe in my life. It does not try and explain why the show is pivoting to this. It's just so wonderful. I loved it. So What We Do in the Shadows, Season 2, it's all streaming on Hulu now.
Fantastic. Pass the baton.
Katie!
Okay, I watched Bad Education on HBO, which premiered in March or so. It's Hugh Jackman, Allison Janney. It's based on a real story about a fraud at a Long Island school. It is very good. It is enjoyable and well-acted. And Geraldine Viswanathan, who we might remember from Blockers, is great. And my icon as a high school journalist, as a former newspaper high school journalist myself. But the real thing that I'm stuck on is that I answered a Twitter meme that said the last movie that you watched, you have to turn into a musical, and mine was Bad Education. And now I'm really fixated on the idea of a Bad Education musical, which Hugh Jackman and Allison Janney could star in. So if you have ideas for what songs would go in that.
Yeah, what would the tone of that be? What's the closest real musical to the Bad Education musical?
Oh, God, that's a great question. I don't know. I feel like the tone would be the, like, same tone as the movie, like a tragicomic, like, kind of caper. I don't know. What's a caper musical?
I'm going to have to think about that one. Maybe we can, yeah. That's the end of this segment.
Like, not Hamilton is the answer, but I don't really.
No.
Give me time.
The Broadway adaptation of Catch Me If You Can, which I saw before it was completely obliterated out of existence and with good reason.
Okay. Well, then I guess my, okay, I guess my idea is a failure. Yeah.
David,
your turn.
Well, what was I going to say about what Patches was talking about? There was something. I can't remember. Oh, right. I was interested in watching What We Do in the Shadows until he said that it had anything to do with The Office, which is about as unpalatable a recommendation as you could possibly make.
Once again, not content.
Right.
I said a lot of people like The Office.
Listen, everything is content, which is definitely not verbatim what Nora Ephron said. Let's see. I'm going to satisfy, let's say, zero of my three co-hosts and one of my two Emerson superfans and recommend recommend is the right word, but talk about a video game again. But it's been reduced to my mini segment part of the show and not a tidbit you've all been spared, but it's Sony's big news.
You don't have to explain it. It's happening. It's happening right now.
It's called Ghost of Tsushima. It's essentially it's an open world game where they essentially are allowing you to play a Kurosawa movie, a samurai movie. There's even a Kurosawa mode in the game that is called that. They had this whole thing with this estate where you can play it in crackling black and white. It's essentially just Assassin's Creed Odyssey, or one of those type of games, but in 14th century Japan. It is stunningly beautiful and kind of repetitive, but overall, I think because of its lush aesthetic and approach to that, and the refined gameplay, worth your 40 hours and change. I still have a lot to do on the island of Tsushima, but.
Does Martin Scorsese show up as Vincent Van Gogh in an homage to Kurosawa films?
Right, because Dreams was definitely a samurai film. I think if you can, you know, not just the Kurosawa films, but if you would look at something like this and be able to point out references to, like, you know, Musashi Miyamoto, Samurai One, or something like that, this is going to be right up your alley. It is definitely heavily indebted to all of those movies. There are missions that feel vaguely related to the plot of something like Seven Samurai, and the whole milieu is obviously in that general world. It's enjoyable. It's interesting. I the reviews are all going to come out tomorrow morning. I'm interested to see what people say about it, but maybe by the time this episode is live, I will have interviewed the directors about how they try to make a playable version of an old-fashioned samurai movie, but it's neat.
There's a new franchise brewing on the old Netflix, and it seems like it has been successful. It is The Old Guard, a story based on comic books by Greg Rucka, who also wrote the screenplay to this film. It stars Charlize Theron and three other dudes as immortal peoples who are cursed or blessed. We kind of get to discuss the details of it during this film, to wander amongst us, righting wrongs, exacting revenge. Apparently, depending on the century, they just fight for what they think is right. All very based on perspective, but their world is thrown into chaos when they are simultaneously hunted by a farmer bro played by Dudley from the Harry Potter series.
That's true.
And
a real Martin Shkreli, whatever his name is.
Real Martin Shkreli.
And come across a new and younger member to the Old Guard who is discovering her immortality. It was directed by Gina Prince Blythewood of Love and Basketball fame. Blythewood?
Blythewood.
Bythewood, yeah. Good. Another one of those names I've never said out loud until now, but there you go. And yeah, it's okay. I'm a person who likes watching lots of flavors of action movie. I'll watch your dumb action movie. I'll watch your gritty action movie. I'll watch your smart action movie. I'll watch your comic-based book-based action movie. And it's really here how I think the style of the film, I can see it being directed competently off of a script that maybe doesn't have the best flow, but it's the non-action scenes that sort of take on what I could only describe as like Tony Scott if he was directing television in the early 2000s, that I just, it's bland and I don't like it and it makes me bored. And it's not that Charlize Theron isn't there giving her stone-faced damnedest to try to make this movie work, but it's just the look of the film outside of the action is so drab, it has trouble holding my attention.
Well, and the characters are every bit as drab, you know, with two key exceptions to my mind, as the visuals. I mean, I think Charlize's character and Kiki Layne's character especially are just total voids of interest or any depth whatsoever.
Wow.
I
did not think those were the two you were going to say who were the the exceptions then.
Oh, the two guys who are in love are great.
I like them a lot, but like they don't really have personalities beyond the fact that they're in love.
Well, I mean, given the relative levels of depth in this movie, it goes along.
Sure.
The scene that has been rightly in the van when
if our bar isn't exclusively gay moment is in a Disney movie, then yes, sure. These guys are. These guys are well making major history.
And I think what's powerful about that moment is not just the love and the romance of it, but it's also just it does give you a sense of the connection that you might have someone if, and this is not so far away from our Palm Springs conversation, but if you were alive with someone for that amount of time and stuck with them because loving someone else might be too painful, but had formed something really beautiful. And I really liked, and those two actors are really great together. But man, I really like Gina Prince-Bythewood. Beyond the Lights is also excellent. In addition to Love and Basketball, I had heard a lot of really good things about this movie, and I thought it was really a miss for me. I just found it everything so bland, and I really like Charlize and Kiki. I think, and I'm close enough with them that I think I can refer to them both by their first names. They, I think, really epitomize just how inert this movie is. There is just no there, and Charlize is able to sort of. You know, bare teeth and go all atomic blonde Furiosa with no pathos behind it and sort of get through in one piece. But Kiki Layne is totally set adrift. I mean, every line is more wooden than the last. I was just so checked out of everything that was happening here. And the one thing that struck a chord with my imagination, other than these two guys, was this one of the other immortals who had been really, truly handed a fate worse than death. I mean, I think something that triggered a lot of agita and phobias, nightmare scenarios from a lot of people who watch this movie, which is being locked in an iron coffin under the sea.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that scene.
And that's not even in the comic book.
Constantly drowning.
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds of years. And that truly seemed miserable. Of course, all I could think about for a few minutes after that was how implausible it was that Andromache would see Titanic and not immediately find a way to get in touch with James Cameron and get her ex-girlfriend off the sea in about 5 minutes.
I mean, if that means anything about what I've learned from Lost, that means that in this universe, we have no proof that James Cameron or any James Cameron movies exist. So people aren't like, oh, shit, there's a Terminator coming down the hall. They just have no words.
I believe there are some pop culture references that would suggest that James Cameron. And that also brings me to the needle drops, which are painful in this movie. Even a great song like Godspeed.
The needle drops are bad.
The needle drops are good.
It's all just like generic pop songs that like sound like you might have heard them before, but like I don't think you have. I can't. They feel like licensable music for a podcast.
Yes.
Whoa! I thought they were cool. There's a bunch of the action scenes are just scored to like kind of pop or R&B songs, and I thought that was cool.
It feels really well. I mean, you're entitled. It really struck me as flat and artificial, but really took me by surprise because especially Beyond the Lights. evinces a real understanding of the interplay between music and image. And it's like the music is so at the core of what that movie is doing. And there is no doubt in my mind that Gina Prince-Bythewood has a really, you know, adept mastery of how to use music in a film like this, which just made all the choices seem so wrong-headed. And that Frank Ocean cue, it isn't even given enough time to register. It feels so jarring. And it's kind of the Waves problem all over again, another movie that dreadfully misused that song.
Wait, hang on. I want to be clear. Wait, David, I'll let you finish and then.
I'm done. I'm done.
Okay. Trashes, I want to be clear that I'm on your side, which I think you know already, that I really like this movie. I think when David says that Charlize Theron and Kiki Layne are wooden and bad, he's wrong, and they are good. Especially yeah. in this opening scene where you meet Kiki Layne's character, who's a Marine. You have this whole sequence where she's trying to uncover some terrorist in a community, and she's going in with her like all female team to try to talk to the women in the neighborhood, and like establishes her as a character so much, and the way that she's been trained to like have like loyalty to her division, and the way that gets upended, and how she finds her new team. Later on, she has these scenes with Chiwetel Ejiofor, who like he plays like a CIA agent, who kind of they have great scenes together.
Can we go back to that opening scene where she's introduced? Because I think
the Afghanistan scene,
that is a really strong scene. You know, where we sort of learn a lot about who she is and how she's able to take command of the situation, how she's sort of, it's a tense moment and she recognizes when things shift in another direction, and it's really involving. But then she spends the rest of the movie just grappling with exposition, just like coming to terms with the most basic realities of her new existence.
Anyway, this movie is setting up a new franchise. It's got a lot of like crumbs to drop where you're like, wonder if that'll be in the sequel, and it will. But I bought into it so much at that point that I was like, yes, give me more. Sorry, go ahead, Batches.
I was just gonna say, just talk about Kiki Layne and stay on this topic. I think that she's the newcomer, so she's witnessing everything through the audience's eyes too. But I found her conversations about family and like dealing with immortality. And there's a scene where Matthias Schoharts sits her down to be like, yeah, I had a son. Or I had four sons and I watched them all die. And the last one was 42 and he died of cancer. I found that stuff pretty poignant. And I was surprised how I was actually more into the drama and the mythology and like weighing the idea of immortality from the different vantage points of all of these characters. Then I was even a lot of the action scenes.
I agree.
It's good, but I think Kiki Layne is actually really good at just being a watchable person who's soaking all this in and trying to process how do you become a Marine and then walk away from that life and like go AWOL and have everyone you would feel so ashamed. And I feel like it's a lot of an internal performance in a movie full of mythological jargon, and that is catnip for me too personally. I mean, I like the mythology and where this is all going.
Loves the mythological jargon.
No, her performance
it's great. Kiki Layne is a very functional player in this movie,
and it's phenomenal.
She's also a bad
person. But I agree that the stuff about like the dramatic stuff about their immortality and its effects and their loss and so on is more interesting than the action. I think it doesn't mean it's all that interesting. It's still pretty surface level. But the action is not involving at all to me. But I think the biggest problem with all the action stuff in this movie is the fatal miscasting of the villain, which is it's completely self-defeating to cast a Martin Shkreli type as the villain and make it all about money, when the only way to add texture to that character is to put some pathos where his money is, and to make it that he's not just a tech bro wearing a hoodie and a blazer, but he's actually believes that, you know, using their blood will be able to.
That's what the Chiwetel Ejiofor character is for. He fills that role.
Yes and no. I mean, he is sort of coming to the place where he can maybe fill that role in the future. His character is vastly underwritten, although we do feel his loss as well. And Chiwetel Ejiofor can find and fit emotion into the head of a pin. But, you know, and he's very good. And for the most of the movie, I was just wondering why he agreed to play such a, you know, a useless role. And then you realize that he's really going to be Bosley in the sequels going forward, and this could be a steady gig for him. But I thought that, you know, just having this money grubbing villain who was, you know, making idle reference to the good that they could do for humanity, not really wanting to grapple with what it would mean to make everyone immortal and the various catastrophes that might come from that, But and then always sort of mealy mouth being like, but really, it's about profits. Nah. It's just like so boring. And he's spending most of the movie just locking them up and chasing them down. He's got his ex special forces. I love all these fucking movies. They just look at the second in command and go, he's ex special forces. And you're like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to watch Charlize Theron and him punch each other for 10 minutes. And
yeah, but this is like the Avatar problem, right? Where you could have something, you could have an even more complicated villain, or the scenario could be more complicated, more textured, and more rooted in real conversations, social conversations. But then the movie gets too complicated. The movie doesn't, it has a brisk feel. Like this movie, even though it takes its breaks, takes its deep breaths, and has these, hold on.
Avatar is outrageous.
No, I'm saying that a movie can be overly complicated and get in its own way. And so often hearing people be like, why doesn't this like push X, Y, and Z harder? Like the simplicity of the movie is what's fun. Weaving in and out of action scenes is fun. Just having enough consideration for these characters is what's fun. And having someone disposable at the end is fun, who you just want to punch in the face. Like the villain is so punchable and you need someone to punch at the end. And that's okay.
If we're taking Mark Zuckerberg to be the villains, then like he deserves it.
Yeah, exactly. Feel that pharma is bad as an entity. Like that, we can get behind that. We can get behind how diabolical it is. That's a good comment to make.
It gives you more time to have jokes about like her knowing Rodan at some point in the past, or like brief flashbacks to the past, or to think about those two dudes meeting in the Crusades, which is awesome.
And I also think it's more impactful to have
I want to just talk what Katie was saying, which is that I can't subscribe to that. I don't believe that in the same episode where we're talking about Palm Springs and how smart that screenplay is, because it eclipses the most obvious joke that anybody in the audience would make about that scenario. This movie is coming under what the most obvious thing would be in any given moment, down to the groan-worthy one-liners that are like sub-late 90s Bond. The whole thing about shooting the Russian pilot, my eyes rolled out of my fucking head.
Why? I don't understand why that's subpar. Why is that? That's a funny gag.
And the stuff like it's a nice moment that Matthias Schoenhart's had his family, and you consider the implications of being alive for this long and having to bury his kids and so forth. But like, this is really still just talking about the most basic level of the premise that you're getting to deal with here, and not allowing for any character growth, anything to hold on to. And the only character I was interested in this movie, again, other than those two guys, and maybe on the periphery, Chiwetel Ejiofor, was the woman who was trapped under the sea in the Iron Maiden for 500 years. And I kept waiting for her to show up as the big bad to somehow be freed, the way that, you know, it might happen to, what's the bad guy? Megatron in the Transformers movie. That there's like my go-to record.
Oh yeah, he is buried at sea. I forgot about that.
It felt so, when she showed up in the post-credit sequence, which I guess we now have gone full spoiler, I felt like,
wow, you just said no full spoilers, then you went full spoilers.
David, I feel like you're steamrolling a lot of the positives here without
I enjoyed to say
that they're subpar. Like I don't really know where you're setting the bar. We see so many bad action movies and so many cookie cutter thrillers that like I don't know. I watched this whole movie and I do think like the first 20 minutes take a while to kind of rev up when they get their assignment from Chiwetel Ejiofor and they show up in the trap. Until then, I kind of was like worried about the movie. It's really slow to start. But as soon as they have to go find Kiki Lane and as soon as people are getting captured, like, I don't know, I expected them to have an advantage. I thought it was really refreshing to not have these people be superheroes. They are immortal, but they still have to fight and they still can get shot and they still can get captured by the bad guys.
Every line is,
I thought that
I'm immortal. Cool. I'm not immortal now. Oh, my immortality is fading. This and that. It's just the movie not being complicated enough to get in its own way, but still, despite the overwhelming simplicity of this movie, it is still tripping over itself to explain the most basic things about it for its entire running time. And that's one of the reasons why one of the parts of the movie I did enjoy actually was those opening 20 minutes, just because, especially in hindsight, you realize that you're just getting the characters sort of in another day, in this infinite stream of days, and they're just going about the regular pattern and feeling each other out, and we're sort of getting, you know, the bond that they have. And I would have loved to see a lot more of that rather than just, you know, going from one plot beat to another in a really haphazard way later on. Dave?
If I were to have a movie about immortals, I want it written by Anne Rice if they're going to be sad about being immortal, because I enjoyed that when it happened in the 90s and read the books about it. I don't disagree with really anything that any of you guys are saying. I this is the straightest shot right down the middle to thing that you should be able to stream on Netflix and then never have to watch again that I've ever seen. So I want Katie to say her thing, but I also want to hear why Patches has watched it twice.
I just wanted to say that I haven't seen a Marvel movie in a long time, nor has anybody, but thinking about this as a comic book superhero-ish movie and the fact that there are no action sequences with like a city levitating or an alien invasion or something like that, that all the action sequences are fights that happen in buildings or in spaces and happen with like a, you know, I think those fight scenes are shot really well. I think the scene with Charlize Theron and Keke Lane on the cargo plane is especially great. And I like a movie that was like has some scale to it, but that doesn't feel like it has to go beyond fights to make those scenes good. Patches, you watched it twice. Yeah, I totally want to watch it again.
I guess I'm shocked that people thought that the music cues were so bad. I guess I got really into having, instead of having like Hans Zimmer, fake Hans Zimmer scores behind every action scene, it's just like tracks selected by the director that seem well matched. And
but didn't it feel like it could have, like they could have gone in a whole different direction? Like there's some needle drops where it's like early enough in the movie, like a song starts and we're over an establishing shot. I'm like, oh, are they just gonna like put in the weird electronic score, like just in the world of the immortals or whatever? And I was so disappointed when like a pop vocalist came on. Like I feel
why?
I feel like this could have been.
Feel like that doesn't happen in action movies like this. It actually just feels really unique. The whole movie kind of reminds me of what Gina Prince Bythewood did in Beyond the Lights. Like take something that's really formulaic and elevate it through perspective and culture and her choices. Like I don't think this is an extraordinary movie. I'm certainly not going to be like, this is the best action movie since Mad Max or something like that. This is the cinematography is nothing to write home about. I don't think it has a real visual identity. But I do think it's concentrated on the characters. It's concentrated on trauma and the relationships. As you said, like the two men who fall in love, they're like, they get a rousing speech. They get some peppery dialogue. And that was fun to see. Like they're always bantering and that's fun and in a romantic way. Or like even Charlize and seeing her through time be in a relationship. And that scene that we kind of briefly described about, her friend or her lover. Or I don't know what powerful relationship they have, but they're strongly connected.
Like that's right up your alley.
They what?
That's right up here. Like what? The cutaway scene where you see Charlize, you know, an ancient battleware
riding a battle. Oh my god, yes.
That for me is a total check out of the movie moment. And
good use of $100,000, whatever that cost. Yeah, that was worth it. Yeah, for sure. I love that. Total catnip. But yeah, and then throwing her over the boat, that scene is, oh my god. I that really gave me some nightmares. But I think the movie has that kind of crushing sense of violence that I wasn't expecting. It will shock you. Like when Matthias Schoharts gets his stomach carved open and his guts are falling out. I'm like, holy shit, this movie's going there. And he's going to have to heal from that.
I'm just saying that if we were all immortal and I, the most annoying member of the podcast, was thrown over a boat in a very clearly defined area of water.
Would we go look
500
for you?
Years.
Yeah.
Well,
you would.
I don't know.
I mean,
what
they had the time to find
take
her.
Us a while.
Well, I'm not saying you would do it like the next day. I mean, you know, a little while.
Wait, are we talking about you or
me? Me. I'm saying, like, you might
right.
wait.
So this might not be the best.
I understand that, but I think.
Yeah, but then he's going to come back and exact his revenge. You got to account for
yes,
that.
Yes, he was obnoxious and he yelled over us about the old guard, but he is constantly drowning and has been for several hundred years, and that does seem difficult. So we should go to this like one square mile worth of sea where we can find him and use modern technology to get him out. I'm just saying,
It would be. I don't know. I can't explain. I'm not here to defend.
I wish this were more of a Gina Prince Bythewood movie. Not that it isn't, of course. And if this is the kind of movie she wants to make, it's certainly.
That's the thing. I feel like it is.
I wish it were a little bit more weighted towards. What I should say is that I wish it were a little bit more weighted towards the human drama of it all, or the inhuman drama, or whatever you want to call what these characters are, and a little bit away from the action stuff, because none of the action stuff, you know, it all comes apart into me.
Well, I will say this. I think that the John Wickification of action is starting to strain. I was not surprised to learn that the fight choreographer on this movie is from Action 8711, that company that the John Wick directors founded, and they've been, you know, all of their people are working on every movie now. I should just say, I hate Atomic Bomb. I hate that fucking movie. It's horrible.
I love it.
It's really boring. It's a boring ass. It's a boring ass movie with nothing going on. Zero character.
Right when I thought
and the
I
action
understood.
Scenes are so
Atomic
boring.
Bomb was on my top 25 of its year. I was.
Yes, and we were all embarrassed.
Now listen,
we couldn't say
that. Never saw Atomic Bomb.
We all have our action movie takes. I'd be really curious to hear from people who like both Atomic Blonde and The Old Guard, or hate both. But
I think I do like. I mean, I like the plane fight in this, but I really love when Kiki Lane decides to like pick up a gun and just decide to. It feels like a character motivated action moment, and I felt the stakes of that. And as much as you groan about Charlize Theron realizing she may not be as immortal as she thought she was, that scared me. I didn't want her to get shot anymore. Maybe mm-hmm. I was very susceptible watching this in the bubble. I definitely experienced this in the kind of almost film fest bubble where I got to watch this before hearing too much about it. So that was fun. But yeah, I just love that third act scene of getting the gang back together and protecting Charlize Theron when you know she can get damaged. That's the beauty of immortal people.
Put the white woman behind the minorities. She can't be shot.
Is that your? Is that going to be your take? Is that your take? First off,
but also, didn't she?
The director is a black woman.
No, I know, but I did think while that moment was happening, this is a really cool example. It's weird that that's the optics of it, because it's something like I would totally do at this point with the powers, but also it was weird. I don't like that hallway fight scene.
They're protecting her friend.
I don't like that hallway fight scene. Where the home hired security is like, wait, you, and then just shoots the first person they don't recognize in the hallways.
Also,
movie's
swords
weird.
And axes are great. That's an extra
more swords and axes
for me.
Yeah.
I like the idea that you need 1,000 years to or more to find her favorite weapon, the one that really, like in a video game, you always just have at the ready because it's the most satisfying to use. I thought that was a nice touch.
No, you only get it at the end of the game. That's the sad part.
right before you're stripped of your invincibility. Yeah.
And you gotta have that. You gotta have that thing where Dudley makes out with it almost, and it's like, is he gonna kiss that axe?
There's a lot of different types of relationships in this movie.
There is.
I will say just to I guess close out that for all of my misgivings about this movie, I cannot deny that maybe it was just because I was so my imagination. Was so taken with whatever her name is, Quinn, who was under the sea for all that time. But the stinger on this movie did leave me, I don't want to say eager, but curious to see a sequel.
One that has
a little bit more breathing room and a little bit more nuance.
We should say she's played by the woman who played Hanoi Hannah in the Defy Bloods. And I don't know her name off the top of my head. I'm going to look it up. But she's having a good Netflix summer. I think she's also in Star Wars.
She is?
Yeah.
Well, either...
Hang on.
Was she in Last Jedi?
I'm going to find this actress's name so that I don't just continue talking about her. And I think it is going to be a name that I'm going to butcher. Oh, Van Veronica. Her last name is NGO. You might know how to say that?
No.
Great.
I think it's a snow. Anyway,
So she plays Paige Tico in Star Wars.
Right. Oh, she's the sister who does not.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sister. Bombing sister.
Anyway,
yeah,
she's great.
She's good in her brief. Greg Rucka talked to Polygon and said that she's an amazing actress, and he would be very
sure she will have a.
She's amazing in Defy Bloods.
In the sequel that will inevitably be made, because at the time of recording, The Old Guard is the most watched thing on Netflix. And
also, if it films in Europe, they can actually make it in the next year.
Right. I mean, I think one of the nice things about watching this movie, which starts in Morocco and then goes to a number of locations from there, is that it did do some serious on-location shooting. And these days, that goes a long way.
The Old Guard.
The Old
Guard. It's the new hotness.
That does it for this week's podcast. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And remember, we have a website called BitingInTheWorm.com. If you do not use any sort of podcast app at all to listen to the show, you can listen to it on your browser. on fightinginthewarroom.com.
I am David Ehrlich. I'm a senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room. Please, please, please leave us a review. We will read them live on air for the first time, come hell or high water.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. I'm also on another podcast called The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. We did a podcast for Stranger in a Strange Land last week that includes a interview between Joanna Robinson and Bai Ling, where Bai Ling tells Joanna about the movie she's making called My Quarantine Romance with Toilet Paper.
Oh, boy.
It is one of the best episodes of podcasting that is going to happen in this year, 2020. Definitely check it out. The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com and on the Little Gold Men podcast there. But this week we're talking about Palm Springs and the Old Guard. Imagine that. And about Peacock, which is a thing. And they're going to tell me what Peacock is because I don't have it yet. You can find all of us, or you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRACH, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about whatever you want, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Palm Springs, what's your worst thing that's happened to you at a wedding?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Bum-ba-dum, the tum-pum-dum. A pom pom dun dun da gung in the ba bum ba bum ba bum. Now I'm done. We're done.